We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
It is my pleasure to introduce a gentleman who is a singer, a songwriter, an actor, and also a music historian, and he has a couple of interesting distinctions. He had a number one record that kind of took its time. In fact, did it ever. It took 5 years from the time it was first released to make number one on the chart, and he owns another distinction. He's probably the guy whose name has been mispronounced more than any other recording artist possibly in history. Is that correct, Billy Vera?
You betcha.
I've been mispronouncing your name for 43 years. If you're doing a concert, do you tell the MC it's Vera, not Vera?
Well, usually I don't have to do that because usually one of my guys makes the announcement, my road manager or somebody, so it's always right.
What about disc jockeys that play your music?
I hear it both ways. A lot of times the wrong way.
Incidentally, the correct pronunciation of the country singer Tammy's last name is not Wynette, which most people say, but she said it was Wynette.
There you go. And I've only heard Wynette all my life.
I know. Amazing.
Yeah.
All right. I am Ronnie Allen, and there's no way to mispronounce me, and it's my pleasure to be doing this show with you. You have just an amazing background. Your name was not really Billy Vera. You were born William McCord, so I guess I could ask how you actually got the name Vera.
Well, my dad was a radio and television announcer on NBC, doing a lot of the quiz shows, Bill McCord. So the first manager I had when I was about 16 said, you know, you don't want people to confuse you with your dad, so come up with another name. And I knew a little girl whose last name was Vera, so I just stole her name.
You stole her last name.
Yeah.
Her first name was not Vera.
No, no.
Otherwise, you would have been Billy Vera.
Or Vera Vera.
By the way, if you want to remember how to pronounce this gentleman's name, think of Yogi Berra, the Yankee cat. I mean, Yogi Berra, B-E-R-R-A. I'm in a crazy mood.
I got you all confused now.
Yeah, oh my gosh, I am in a crazy mood. Now think of B-E-R-R-A, or just mentally add an R that's not there, and you get B-E-R-R-A, and they say, oh, it's Billy Vera.
Or Geraldo Rivera.
Geraldo, I always thought it was Geraldo Rivera. No, let's move on. You actually were born in Riverside, California, I believe.
Right, yeah, my dad was stationed in the Air Force during the war at March Field, which was the Air Force base in Riverside.
It was around 1962 that you began your singing career as a member of a group called the Resolutions?
Yeah, and that was just a bunch of guys that was put together to make one record. In fact, that was that same manager that suggested I change my name.
What record are we talking about?
The title of the song was January 1st, 1962. Some guy wrote this song, and the manager got a hold of it, and he said, all right, I'm going to put a bunch of you guys together in the studio and record the song. And it actually got played on American Bandstand a few times.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
That's nice.
But it didn't sell any records.
Well, at least you got some notoriety.
Yeah.
It was a brief amount.
However slight.
However slight, yeah. Do you play an instrument, by the way, on your records?
On some of my records, I play guitar or piano, yeah.
All right, well, back then, as a member of the Resolutions, were you just the lead singer, or were you just...
That one, it was a studio concoction. I sang lead, and then I overdubbed the bass part and the falsetto part.
As a songwriter, I understand that you struck pay dirt, albeit a small pay dirt, with the very first song that you took to a publisher.
First song I ever took to a publisher was called Mean Old World, and that ended up being recorded by Ricky Nelson. And he did it 5 weeks in a row on the Ozzy and Harriet show, and it became a minor chart record for him.
Wow.
Which was pretty astounding, you know, the first time I ever took a song to a publisher and it became a minor hit by Ricky Nelson.
What?
That was a big deal.
What year was this?
1965.
Did you write this by yourself?
Yeah, wrote it at my mother's piano.
I walk in a crowd, hiding tears I can't cry out loud. I can't let them see me cry, cause they don't care if I live or die. And it's a mean old world, let me tell you, it's a mean old world. When you need It's a room filled with gloom. I sit and wait by the telephone, but no one cares if I'm all alone. And it's a mean old world. Let me tell you, it's a mean old world when you need someone. Sometimes my friends don't understand me. Sometimes they can be so cruel. All I hope is someday I find someone to love my whole life through. I walk down the street, hide my face from the people I meet. They don't see the tears in my eyes. They don't care or even realize that it's a mean old world. Let me tell you, it's a mean old world when you need someone. It's a mean old world. You need someone. Oh, it's a mean old world. Babe, I need someone. Oh, it's a mean old world. Oh, I need someone.
So did you really think that the world was pretty mean when you wrote that? It seemed to be pretty good for you as a songwriter.
Yeah, it did pretty good. Actually, you know, the funny thing was, I wrote that with this new girl singer in mind that I had heard on the radio. I thought it would be a great song for her. At first, I was disappointed that she didn't record it. The girl was Dionne Warwick.
Oh, Dionne Warwick, Dionne Warwick. I think I know the name.
But I didn't realize that Bachrach and David had her all tied up. So I didn't have a chance of getting the Dionne Warwick record on that one.
One of my favorite oldies by Barbara Lewis is a song called Make Me Belong to You. That's one I'm sure you're familiar with, right, Billy?
Yeah, Chip Taylor and I wrote that song.
Ah!
I had just gotten a job as a staff songwriter at a publishing company, and Chip was an executive and a songwriter there, and that was the first song that he and I wrote together.
To you, Barbara Lewis, She liked to do these Make Me songs. She had a record earlier called Make Me Your Baby. You remember
that's
that?
Right.
Barbara was a great recording artist, and she's still out there performing. I understand that Fats Domino did a recording of Make Me Belong to You.
Yeah, in those days, you know, if you had a hit record and the song lent itself to it, you did a lot of covers. Mm-hmm. And we had maybe 25, 30 covers of that song in all over the world in different languages. And one of them was by one of my childhood heroes, Fats Domino.
You know, I just happen to have a copy of the Fats Domino record, and you don't mind if we hear a little bit of Fats' rendition of that song?
No, I love his version.
Darling, I am whatever you make me. So baby, baby, whatever you make me, make me belong to you. I can be your baby or a king. You got the power to make me anything. You got the power to open your heart. It's up to you, it's up to you. Cause darling, I am whatever you make me. So baby, baby, whatever you make me, make me belong to you.
The great Fats Domino doing a great song, co-written by Billy Vera, Make Me Belong to You. You also had songs, and this is again in the 60s. At least one of them was recorded by the Shirelles.
One was called Hung on Yourself. Another one was called Caught Me When My Love Was Down.
Caught Me When My Love Was Down.
Yeah.
I'm Ronnie Allen talking to the very talented and very accomplished and very versatile. Did I read that exactly as you wrote it? Billy Vera. And we're moving on now. So you kind of cut your teeth by writing several songs in the 60s. You wrote a garage band classic called Don't Look Back. Tell me a little bit about that and the group that recorded it called The Remains.
That song was written on an assignment for the soul singer Chuck Jackson. And Chuck didn't record it. And my publisher got it to Epic Records. And they had this new band called The Remains from up in the New England area. And, boy, I heard their record. It was not what I expected the song to sound like, but it was great. And I thought it was going to be a big hit, and it turned out it was not. Mm-hmm. And the group got dropped by their label after one album. They opened for the Beatles on the Beatles' last tour
of
America.
That's a claim to fame, I guess.
Oh, yeah. They're I mean, they're a legendary. Over the years, they've become this legendary cult band.
Right.
And they recently, last year, did a documentary on them. They used my song twice in the movie. I didn't make any money off the song for many, many, many years. And then, you know, the song was used on a compilation called Nuggets, which became this kind of famous album compilation of those kind of bands.
This is one that you wrote by yourself?
Uh-huh.
Don't Look Back, written by Billy Vera, and these are The Remains. We'll be right back.
strange ideas on how life should be lived and things should be done. But I'm here to say you gotta do just what you want. And when they start of that talk, talk, talking, remember just one thing.
My guest, and once again, I want to thank you, Billy, for taking the time to do this interview with me. I'm thrilled.
My pleasure.
I've been following your career for years, even though I didn't know how to pronounce your name. I knew a lot of what you did, and most people, I would think, became aware of you in 1967, because after all, what you hear on the radio generally are DJs saying, and this is by such and such a recording artist. Yeah, you might have gotten, you know, some play with some other songs that you wrote before, but now you're an artist. What label was Storybook Children on?
Well, that was on Atlantic. We had gotten entree to the company because we had the hit with Barbara Lewis, who was also an Atlantic artist.
Mm-hmm.
So Chip and I decided, well, let's write a duet. Maybe we'll get two Atlantic artists to record it. So we made a demo of the song with me and a girl singing, and we took it up to Jerry Wexler, the big boss up there, and he pounded his fist on the desk and declared it a smash. And he said, I'll tell you what, get rid of the girl in the demo and I'll record you on Atlantic. I was friendly with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells because they were also on Atlantic, and I had played behind them quite a few times. And one of the girls in the group, Nona Hendrix, had a voice that blended well with mine. She's lower voice than Patti. So I called her in Philly and asked her if she'd like to make a record with me, and she said sure. So we recorded the song, and then their manager was afraid that the group would break up if Nona and I had a hit, and so we had to go audition 20 more girl singers. And they all, you know, they were all adequate. They sounded like they should be singing Stephen Sondheim songs or something. And finally, when we were about to give up, Wexler called up and said that they had gotten this girl, Judy Clay. So we took a listen to her, and she was great. And so we went in and recorded it with her.
This was an interracial duet.
Yes, yes. It was probably the first interracial duet that sang love songs. You know, back
right,
in the 40s,
yeah.
You had Joe Stafford and Cy Oliver with Tommy Dorsey's band singing Yes Indeed, and you had Anita O'Day and Roy Eldridge.
Right? That's it. A good thing was named Roy Eldridge, so Let Me Off Uptown.
Right, with Gene Krupa's band.
Oh, great, great record. Now, you also had, of course, integrated groups. You had the Del Vikings, you had
the Powers,
and the Crest, of course, yes. But this was like a love duet, so this was kind of avant-garde. We're talking 1967.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't our intention to make history, you know, but that was the kind of the sound of voice we wanted. We were going by the sound rather than by the skin color.
Right. Now, was this a co-write again?
Yeah, Chip and I.
It became a national hit, and we're going to listen to it right now. This is Billy Vera and Judy Clay. Beautiful song called Storybook Children.
You've got your world, and I've got mine. And it's a shame two grown-up worlds that will never be the same. Why can't we be like storybook children?
hand in hand across the meadow. Why can't we be like storybook children in a wonderland where nothing's planned for tomorrow? You've got his ring, you've got his heart, you've got his baby.
And Billy, it's too late to turn away and start all over again. Oh no, don't tell me it's too late, baby. Why can't we be like storybook children running through the rain? Across the meadow. Hold my hand one more time. Why can't we be like storybook children in a wonderland?
In a wonderland
where nothing's planned for tomorrow.
How happy we would be if only we
were storybook children.
Storybook Children, Billy Vera and Judy Clay. I'm Ronnie Allen talking to Billy. This is kind of interesting. The follow-up single did something that Storybook Children did not do, and that is it actually made the national top 40. It got to number 36, but you told me privately that Storybook Children was actually the bigger hit.
Yeah, and the way that works is when Country Girl City Man, the follow-up, came out, it was following a hit, so all the stations went on it at the same time. Whereas with the first one, you know, it might have gone to number 5 in Cleveland in October, and
I see
number 1 in New York in December, you know, so you weren't getting the
everything happening at the same time type of thing. Yeah.
And that's what makes a record go higher on the charts, yeah. But actually, Storybook Children sold about 5 times as many records as Country Girl City Man, which went higher on the charts.
Nevertheless, it's a good song. Was this another co-write with you and
Chip? Wrote that with Ted Darrell. Teddy was best known for a song called She Cried by Jay and the Americans.
I think we know that one. That was the one that Jay Traynor did the lead on.
Yeah, the great Jay Traynor.
The great Jay Traynor. Well, we're going to listen to the one that actually did make the top. This actually was your first top 40 hit, actually. It got to number 36. And this is, again, Billy Vera and Judy Clay and Country Girl, City Man.
Girl, you're looking kind of pretty, don't you think we ought to
get to know each other better? Take the time to find out why we can.
Gotta be so between a country girl and a city man.
We can find it's grooving just across the line.
City boy had your eggs and bacon,
you were raised on cornbread.
While I was waiting,
about the time I was going to bed. Bet we got a lot in common. Take the time to find out why we can.
Gotta be some soul between a country girl and a city man.
We can find it moving just across the line. Hey, baby.
Thank you.
Country Girl, City Man, Billy Vera, and Judy Clay. And I'm talking to Billy right now. And we're going to move to a recording of yours that is one of my all-time favorite songs. It's not a song that you wrote. It's a song that somebody else that I interviewed wrote. His name, Bobby Goldsboro. And how did you get to record with pen in hand?
Well, Judy and I were performing at the Apollo Theater, and I get a call backstage from Jerry Wexler one day. You know, Judy had been signed to Atlantic through Stax Records, a distribution deal, and the distribution deal had expired. So Jerry said, you guys won't be able to record together anymore because Stax is going away. But he said, the good news is I found a song for you on Bobby Goldsboro's album, and he said, I think it's a hit. And Jerry was a great song man, so you didn't doubt him when he told you that. And he said, when do you finish the Apollo? I said, well, we finished Thursday night. He said, well, Friday morning, 9 o'clock, be in here. I'll have a full orchestra for you, and we'll record the song. And then by Monday, he had test pressings with typed labels at every radio station in the country. He was determined to make that a hit.
With pen in hand, you sign your name today at 5. I'll be on that train, and you'll be free, and I will be alone, so all alone. If you think we can't find the love we once knew, if you think I can't make everything up to you, that I'll be gone, you'll be on your own, you'll be on your own. And I wonder, can you take good care of little Billy? Can you take him to school? Can you tell him about the man in the moon? If you can do these things, then maybe he won't miss me. Maybe he won't miss me. And tonight, as you lay in that big lonely bed, can you look at the pillow where I laid my head? And with your heart on mine, will you have no desire to kiss me and to hold me? And if you can forget the good times we had, if you think that the good times don't outweigh the bad, then sign your name and I'll be on my way.
When I hear that song, it's such a beautiful and very, very sad song.
Oh, sure is.
I understand that there was some connection with Clive Davis with that particular recording. Did he want to get it out with another recording artist? Is that what happened?
Well, Clive had recorded it with Jerry Vale 2 weeks before we got in the studio with it. You know, I mean, other people had heard about the song already, and people were jumping to record it because it was such a great song. But, you know, Columbia was a big, cumbersome corporate company, and by the time they got it out, he got it out 2 weeks after mine came out. The publishing company I was writing for was owned by Columbia Records and CBS, so Clive called us up to have lunch at the executive ballroom, and he said, "Billy, you're a wonderful recording artist and a great singer and songwriter, and it would be an honor and a privilege to have you on Columbia Records." And, you know, I was all of 23 years old, and I was still at the point of being honest. So I said to him, "Well, you know, Mr. Davis," I said, "you know, all my life, you know, I listened to Ray Charles and the Coasters and the Drifters and Bobby Darin and Aretha Franklin and all these great Atlantic artists." I said, "I can't imagine myself wanting to be anywhere else but Atlantic Records." So he was quite insulted and never spoke to me again. In fact, many years later, I sent him a demo of At This Moment before I recorded it for Whitney Houston, and he sent me back a rejection slip that I framed.
Well, we're going to get to, actually, At This Moment is going to be the last record that we're going to play on the show. You wrote a number one hit song for Dolly Parton. I really got the feeling. This was one that you wrote yourself?
Yeah. When the 70s came along, you know, music changed pretty radically, and I couldn't figure out how to fit myself in there. I was playing survival gigs for almost 10 years.
Wow.
And one night I was playing at some Ramada Inn in New Jersey or something, and this guy came in with his wife and he introduced himself as Larry Brown, L. Russell Brown, the writer of Tie a Yellow Ribbon. He said, "Vera, you know," he says, "you're a great singer and a great songwriter," he said, "but you never make any money." He said, "Me, I make a lot of money and nobody respects me." He said, "Maybe we should do some things together, and, you know, I could teach you how to write songs that make money and you could teach me how to write songs that get respect." So that sounded like a pretty good idea to me, and we wrote a bunch of things together. And one day he got a gig producing Nancy Sinatra. He said, "I'm recording Nancy tomorrow and I need one more song." He said, "You got anything for her?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, listen, I got to go pick up my wife. See if you can come up with something by the time I get back." So, you know, I knocked this little song out in about 20 minutes with lines like, "I love my daddy, but it really don't matter what my daddy might say," for Nancy.
Wow.
Thinking of Frank.
Uh-huh.
Well, he played it for Nancy. She hated the song, and I mean, really hated it, and didn't record it. And Larry was mad because he said, "This is better than anything I wrote." He said, "You got to do something with this song to prove me right." So that got me excited, and we went in and recorded the song with a girl that was singing in a friend of mine's band. And she was kind of lazy, and she didn't really learn the song properly. So everywhere we took the record, the response was, "Love the song, hate the girl. Love the song, hate the girl." Well, finally, I was at the last place on my list, a guy named Charlie Koppelman. And he said, "Love the song, hate the girl, but," and that's the first time I got that far, he said, "but we're recording Dolly next week. Let me have the song for her."
Uh-huh.
He said, "I'll guarantee it'll be the single."
What year are we talking about?
End of 78.
By the way, Charlie Koppelman was a member of the Ivy Three who did,
that's right,
who did Yogi. So you got a chance to have a Dolly Parton single. And everything she was recording was hitting the top of the chart. And
well, she was hot at that point. She was just coming off her album, Here You Come Again.
Yeah.
So this was the follow-up album to that.
Yeah.
We recorded it, and at that point I got an offer to move to California from New York. So I was driving out with everything I owned in my car. Every 20 minutes I'm hearing my song. And I said, "Wow, I'm back in showbiz, you know."
Wow.
And the day I hit L.A., Dolly's record hit number one.
From the moment we met.
imagine what it might have sounded like if Nancy Sinatra had recorded it, which she didn't. Great number one country hit. So that gave you credentials as a number one country songwriter.
Yeah. I mean, I had been on the country charts before. There was a cover version. Lee Hazelwood, who was
Work with Nancy.
Yeah, they recorded Storybook Children together previously.
Oh.
On their big album, Nancy and Lee. And then Lee loved the song so much, he recorded a country version with a couple of artists called Virgil Warner and Susie Jane Holcomb. And they had a minor chart record with Storybook Children.
Storybook Children had a lot of legs.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, it was also a chart record in the 70s by Sam Dees and Betty Swan. And it was a big reggae record by a guy named Gregory Isaacs.
Oh, gosh. That has got to be a fantastic copyright then.
It still makes money all these years later, yeah.
Virgil Warner and Susie Jane Holcomb.
That's country names, huh?
Country names, definitely. Absolutely.
No question what genre they fit in.
No. None at all. Before we get to the concluding parts of our interview at the moment, and Billy and the Beaters, I want to talk about your career as a music historian.
I did a lot of reissue work. In other words, compiled and produced and anthologized and wrote the notes for over 200 CDs and box sets.
Wow.
Ranging from the Ray Charles 50th anniversary box set that was nominated for a Grammy. I did a Little Richard box set. I've done 7 Nat King Cole CDs. You know, a whole
wow.
bunch of things.
What labels put these out?
Well, Rhino did a lot of stuff for Capitol. Label over in England called Ace Records.
Oh, yeah. That's a biggie. Not the same Ace Records now that Frankie Ford and Jimmy Smith and the Clowns. Different Ace Records.
Yeah.
So you've done over 200 of these?
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing. That's amazing.
It's fun. It's actually the most fun thing I do. You know, you're like a kid in the candy store going
still
in the vault.
Still do it, right? You're still putting out compilations?
Well, that end of the business has slowed down a lot with the death of the CD.
Yeah,
you know, sadly.
Everything is online, everything is downloading.
Most people like to download now, and plus most of the stuff from the period I'm an expert at has been reissued by now, so there's not much left to put out.
You also did work on a book that Norman Knight wrote. Were you involved with both Rock On 1 and Rock On 2? Or?
Yeah, that's so long ago, I'm not sure. I know I get all these calls late at night, you know, well, who is this person and what did they do? What do you know about this one and what, you know, that kind of thing. So I wasn't really involved in the sense that I was a co-writer or made a dime from it.
Particularly not making a dime from it, I guess.
Yeah, I just took a lot of phone calls from Norman in the middle of the night. You know?
Oh, I see. And I know a guy named Ralph M. Newman, who was the publisher of a couple of publications, Bim Bam Boom and Time Barrier
yeah.
Express, and I know that you were very close with him as
yeah,
well. And
still am.
And you still are. So I want to say a shout-out to Ralph M. Newman, and hope you're listening to this show, and what a joy it is. He used to always talk about you. He used to always say what a great guy Billy was. Your filmography includes a lot of TV shows and movies. People, if you go to the Internet Movie Database, which is IMDb, you could check out the credits of Billy Vera. I'm looking at TV shows, Beverly Hills 90210. Is there any one or two things that you want to just maybe mention as like a high point there? Of the,
well, the first one I ever did was a movie called The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, which has become this weird cult movie. I mean, it's like Star Trek, you know, minor Star Trek.
1984 for that one, the Pinky Carruthers?
Yeah, they just did a screening of it about 2 months ago out here in L.A., and Peter Weller, the star, and I were asked to come and speak before they showed the film.
Oh.
And the place was sold out with these people that are like Buckaroo Banzai fanatics. If you ever have time, take a look at the cast. Virtually everybody in the movie went on to be somebody. Jeff Goldblum,
wow.
Just a whole bunch of people.
That's great. Well, I've got to point out that you go to the IMDb page and there's 27 different credits. So I'm not going to read any of the others right now, but I want you all out there to do your homework, and there'll be a surprise quiz next week. So take copious notes, as I like to say. One thing, actually, tonight's the night. You actually played a lead singer, 1987?
Oh, tonight, yeah. We did about 6 songs in there.
Ah.
As the director was editing the movie, it was a TV movie for ABC.
Yeah.
He kept calling me up. He said, man, ABC's on my back. He said, they want more of you in there. Mm-hmm. because At This Moment was rising up the charts as he was doing the editing.
Right.
He said, by the time I get finished editing this thing, it's going to be a Billy Vera video.
Now, how did Billy Vera and the Beaters come along? Why all of a sudden does a solo singer decide that he wants to be part of a group?
Well, when I moved out here, you know, I didn't know anybody. I ran into one of my old bass players from New York who had moved out here a couple of years earlier. I really had no plans to be a performer anymore. I figured, you know, 34 years old, I was over the hill as a rock and roll singer.
Absolutely, yes.
So one day, Chuck Fiore said, why don't you come out to Venice? He said, I play with a bunch of guys out there just for fun. And so I sat in with them, and they were great. And then we were talking, and they said, maybe we ought to put together a band. We could meet some girls, you know, have something to do on the weekend. So that was really the reason why we started the band, just for fun and to meet girls. We ended up getting a gig every Monday night at midnight, the worst night of the week, late night, at the world-famous Troubadour. And within 2 weeks, it was packed. It was sold out every Monday night, lines around the block.
Right.
And we became like the hottest thing in town. And all the record company guys would come and see us, but nobody would reach for their wallet. Or their checkbook. You know, because, you know, record companies being what they are, they sign acts that sound like what's already in the top ten. And at that time, My Sharona was big, so they were signing acts like that.
We talk like the Knack.
Four-piece bands. Here we were, 10 pieces with horns, and, you know.
You had a different sound. Now, this is 1979, around that time?
1980, yeah.
Okay. Because My Sharona came out around 79, so this was about 1980. Did you ever feel that maybe I'm never going to get a recording contract?
Yeah, I'd been in the business long enough to understand that that's what they do. They sign acts that sound like what's hot at the time.
Yes, yeah.
And if you're different, you really have to wait it out until all those acts fail.
Right.
And then they start looking for something different. And so that's exactly what happened. So it took us about a year. And in the course of 1 week, we got 3 offers of record deals.
Wow.
We decided to go with this Japanese company called Alpha Records. We chose those over a couple of big labels because we figured we'd get more attention from them. We'd be the first act on the label and all the publicity would go to us, which is what happened.
Right.
And we ended up with a little hit record called I Can Take Care of Myself.
Did you write that song?
I did, all by myself.
Did you play guitar in this group in addition to singing?
Yeah. Yeah, I did both.
So how many horns did you have in the group?
4.
4 horns?
4 saxes and a pedal steel.
Right.
And guitar, bass, piano, and drums, and
so
me.
When we think of groups with horns, we obviously think of Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears, but your group was more R&B oriented, so to speak. So
yeah, my inspiration was Ray Charles. And, you know, most of the guys that are just a little bit younger than me, whether it's 2 or 3 years younger than me, grew up listening to, you know, Sam and Dave and Otis Redding records.
Right.
And as great as those records are, there's very little subtlety to them. You know, it's all, they start at 10 and they end at 10. But Ray Charles had lots of dynamics. There were highs and lows and quiet parts and loud parts. And that was what I drilled into the band. And that's what made us sound different than all the other horn bands.
Song called I Can Take Care of Myself.
Just at the latest boutique, your place is furnished like the president's suite. Your freezer's filled up with the finest of meat. Somehow you manage on 100 a week. They say you like to feel white gold on your neck. They say when you make love you like to direct. And that new sports car you proceeded to wreck. They say I ought to ask who picked up the check. I can take care of myself. My friends all say I ought to think twice. I can take care of myself. I don't need nobody's advice. You're so nice. Attempt to charm you met with little success. Never met someone so hard to impress. Until one day by chance you saw my address. The next day you had on your lowest cut dress. But I can take care of myself. My friends all say I
in their judgment of you. Maybe you'll take me and make me a fool. But I'm a big boy and I know what to do. It might be worth it to wake up next to you.
On the Alpha label, A-L-F-A, I can take care of myself. What about the name The Beaters? The Beaters doesn't exactly sound like a name for an R&B-based group. It sounds close to the Beatles. What was the inspiration for the name The Beaters?
Well, the drummer's sister, she was in the business, and she was at one of our rehearsals one day. We were trying to come up with a name for the band. And she said, well, you know, my brother's wife just left him. Chucky's girlfriend just dumped him. Billy, you haven't met any girls out here. You know, the piano player doesn't have a girlfriend. You know, you're all here looking to meet girls. That's why you started the band. You guys ought to call yourself the Beaters. Ha, ha, ha.
So ha, 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 you did.
So we showed her.
Yes, you did. Any rate, that record was called I Can Take Care of Myself. Got to number 39. The follow-up recording didn't do quite as well. It was something called At This Moment. And if it's okay, can we just hear just a few bars of At This Moment? You don't mind me playing just a few bars of it. It did get to number 79 on the chart. Is that okay with you, Billy?
Oh, if you must.
It was kind of a minor hit. I'm going to play an excerpt from it. This was a follow-up to I Can Take Care of Myself, Billy Vera and the Beaters, At This Moment.
Did you think I would do at this moment when you're standing before me with tears in your eyes trying to tell me that you found you another, you just don't love me no more.
Well, that's a nice little song, Billy. It got to number 79 on the chart, but that should have done better.
Catchy little tune.
Billy Vera, thank you so much for doing this show.
Thank you for having me.
Are you still performing?
Yeah, we play a couple of times a month, you know, still.
Check out Billy's website, billyvera.com. Check him also out on the IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, for all of those credits. And you could actually check out the Wikipedia article as well, which you've assured me is accurate. You fixed up any errors that were in there.
I did.
Billy, the story does not end with that record going to number 79. That was in the year 1981. The record did something that I don't think any other record that I can recall has done. 5 years after its release, it hit number one on the chart. That record was recorded live at the Roxy Theater in L.A., is that correct?
Yeah, Sunset Strip.
Were you recording other songs as well?
Well, yeah, I Can Take Care of Myself was also recorded that night. We did a whole album live at the Roxy.
There is no way that I can envision you ever saying to yourself that this record that peaked at number 79, which maybe was a little bit of a disappointment that it didn't take off back in 1981, there's no way that anybody could have told you that 5 years from now your record's going to be number one in the country, and you would have actually said, hey, you know, I really believe you.
Well, the company Alpha went out of business in the States, and we were without a record deal, and nobody wanted to give us a record deal for the next 5 years, and I was kind of making my living as an actor and living off royalties from my old songs. And one day I get a phone call from a guy named Michael Whitehorn, and he said, I produce a show called Family Ties, which was the number two show in the country at the time. He said, we were at the club the other night, and we heard you do this song. We think it would be great for this episode we're going to do. And so I arranged for them to use the song. You know, other people had used my songs in TV shows mm-hmm. before that. And, you know, all that meant was a couple of $100, and that's really nice. Okay. Next. You know.
Next, yeah, right.
And, but the next day we got a bunch of mail, and they were phone calls. And this hadn't happened before. And so I got the idea to try to get a record company to let me re-record the song, and nobody was interested. And finally I'm having lunch with Richard Foose, who was the owner of Rhino Records, and I said, Richard, how many records do you need to sell to break even? He said, oh, about 2,000. We have a low overhead here at Rhino.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, if I guarantee you 2,000, we put out an album of my alpha material.
Mm-hmm.
He said, sure. And because we were friends, and he kind of did it mostly as a favor to me. And so he did, but by the time they got it out, we missed the reruns of Family Ties.
Uh-huh.
And then they used the song a second time the following season when the girl breaks up with Michael J. Fox. Okay. Well, this time the story of the song, Boy Loses Girl, is the same as the story of the episode, Boy Loses Girl.
I see.
And this time America went nuts. And NBC said, man, we got more phone calls and letters, you know, than we've ever gotten in the history of the network for any song. And people started calling radio stations. And we had no promotion, nothing. Because Rhino is not in the business of making contemporary records.
And they're not known as a singles label.
No, no, not at all. So the record really took off all by itself and quickly went to number one.
It stayed number one for 2 weeks, was on the chart for 21 weeks. You didn't recut it, did you?
No, no, it was the same
this
original.
It was the actual same recording that on Alpha Records got to number 79 5 years earlier.
And today, I own all those Alpha recordings.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to close the show right now. I can't see any way that we can follow this one. I mean, this is like the peak of your career.
I'd say, as
Norm Crosby would say, it's the pinnacle of your career. This is Billy Vera and the Beaters and the number one hit that has become a classic at this moment.
What did you think I would do at this moment when you're standing before me with tears in your eyes? Found you another, you just don't love me no more. What did you think I would say at this moment when I'm faced with the knowledge that you love me? Did you think I would curse you or say things to hurt you? 'Cause you just don't love me no more. Did you think I could hate you or raise my hands to you? Now come on, you know ground that you walk on. If I could just hold you again, walk on, baby. If I could just hold you. If I could just hold you. If I could just hold you. Again.
To Ronnie remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
Well, that's the show. Now a couple of bonus tracks by Billy Vera. Here's one from 1969, and it's called The Bible Salesman.
Johnson, the church sent me around. Let me slip my foot inside your door and take my suitcase down. Got something for your comfort when you're feeling all alone. I'm your good friend, the Bible salesman. I'm coming. Words of Jesus, and it comes in white or gold. Got payment plans A, B, or C. I can check your credit by phone. I'm your good friend, the Bible salesman. I'm coming, coming,
coming.
Glad to be of your assistance on your road to the promised land. I remember you when your payment's due, so you never have to feel alone. I'm your good friend, the Bible salesman. I'm coming,
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 coming, coming, coming,
coming for the care you.
Finally, here's a song done by Billy and the Beaters in 1981. You may recall the song. It was originally done by the Marathons back in the early 60s. Billy Vera and the Beaters doing Peanut Butter.
Well, there's a food going round peanut butter, creamy peanut butter, chunky peanut butter too. Well, I went to a party and what did they eat? Peanut butter, chunky peanut butter too. Butter, chunky peanut butter too.